You're listening to the Radiator 105.9 FM WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you're going to hear actually one of my favorite interviews. This is from the archives, and it's an interview with the poet Natasha Saye, whose first book of poems, Red Under the Skin, won the Agnes Lynch Starrett Prize and the Towson State Prize in Literature. Her second book was Bend, which won the Utah Book Award in Poetry. Her honors include a Fulbright Fellowship, the Robert Winner and Alice Faye de Castagnola Awards from the Poetry Society of America, the Bannister Writer-in-Residence at Sweetbriar College, and the Campbell Corner Poetry Prize. Her poems, translations, reviews, and essays appear in many journals, including the Kenyon Review, The New Republic, Parnassus, Plowshares, Shenandoah, Best American Poetry, and The Writer's Chronicle. Natasha is an associate professor of English and director of the Weeks Poetry Series at Westminster College in Salt Lake City. When I spoke to her in 2009, I started out by asking about her background and her path to poetry.
Well, English is not my first language, so I think that I was drawn to writing, and in particular poetry, because it's a way of exploring the fact that words don't mean what they say, that language is not transparent, that there's more than one way of approaching a concept. Mm-hmm. You know, so German was my first language, and when I learned English at the age of 5, I suddenly had two ways of saying the same thing, but it wasn't the same thing. I understood that, and that made me, I think, want to be a writer, along with the fact that I was probably alienated by by the experience of being a foreign child in a, you know, in U.S. culture.
Yeah, that is very interesting. And you also speak French and Italian now, too?
Well, French. I'm pretty fluent in French, and I can read Italian.
Okay. And you use them somewhat in your poetry, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, that's fun to read. Mm-hmm. I always find it fun to read when there are other, you know, linguistic influences in poetry. So you've shared a group of recent poems with me, and I'm wondering if you can talk about what this project is.
Okay. My third book of poems is an abecedarium. So the spine of it is poems simply titled by letters of the alphabet, and they were spurred by, I'll tell you my process. I have an American Heritage Dictionary that I got when I was 16, because I worked in my high school library and they wanted to thank me for my work. So, and that's the dictionary I actually use that has etymology in it.
Okay.
So I go through a letter and make a list of words that I don't know. And sometimes they have an interesting etymology and sometimes they don't, but it's a list of words that I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I try to make them cohere in some way. So I put an emotion into it, or a narrative situation, or I just try to see what they evoke in me. So it's a writing exercise.
Right.
I don't come to those poems with any preconceived ideas. I just let the words sort of bubble up whatever I want to write about. And then I realized that it would be more interesting to not have all the poems be titled letters of the alphabet, but to have poems that evoke letters without explicitly addressing them. And a lot of the letter poems rely on consonants and assonants.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the, what I think of as the muscle and fat poems in between, have less alliteration, and there'll be a ghost of a letter. So, for instance, palimpsest was one of the poems. That'll be a P because the form is also a pantoum.
Okay.
So the P works in a more subtle way than in B, which has Boer and Francis Bacon and that kind of thing.
And are those poems that aren't entitled A, B, C,
yes,
are they alphabetically?
They will be. that we were alphabetically arranged. The reason I liked the alphabetical arrangement is also it took a level of control out of the whole process. Yes and no. I mean, I suppose I could write a poem and then decide that it doesn't fit and mm-hmm. take it out, or I could write a poem and change the title so that it does fit.
Okay.
There's an element of randomness that appeals to me about the whole stretch of it.
Yeah.
The whole stretch. Plus, you need more than 26 poems to make a book.
Sure.
So I've also started writing poems inspired by letters in other alphabets.
Oh, I noticed the Slovenian.
Yes.
What is that called?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. It's really fun because of the juxtaposition of randomness and decisions that are made for me and decisions that I get to make very consciously.
Right.
So the interplay of unconscious and conscious.
Yes. Right. One of the poems is titled Against Chronology. I was wondering if you'd mind reading that one first.
Sure. I think this will be the first poem in the book, but I'm not sure. I may have to take it out if I don't like it anymore. It's an argument, as the title suggests. And I'll explain the form maybe after I read it.
Sure.
Okay. So, without Agnes Day, within air conditioning, via antigens, unlike Beethoven, until carbon dating, under a dynamo, toward the Eocene epoch, to the Flintstones, till the flood, through Freud, since the graviton, regarding gunpowder, Per Gutenberg, past homophobia, outside internal combustion, on top of the Ku Klux Klan, onto the court of Louis XIV, on Medicare, off the middle class, next to the New Age, minus the old masters, like Marco Polo, into Qatar, instead of Roundup, in front of the silkworm, from the Song of Songs, for the Spanish Armada, except sulfides, during the Titanium Age, down with the Union Jack, by the Vikings, between Da Vinci and the Young Pretender, below the Well of Loneliness, behind Westinghouse, atop womankind, at Woolworth's, around the wreck of the Deutschland, among xenophobes, along the Y chromosome, after Yankee Doodle, about the zeitgeist, aboard the zephyr of time.
Thank you very much. I loved that one. Okay. And what really struck me was when I was in probably fifth grade, we had to learn all the prepositions alphabetically, which I can still say, you know, the A's and some of the B's. And when I got to the bottom of this poem, I'm like, oh, I get what she's doing. So you want to talk about it?
Yeah. Well, the argument, I don't like the way that chronology is used to explain things because it's usually not the answer. You know, people say, well, that came before this, so therefore it was causal or if it was influential. Mm-hmm. Especially with literary writers, there's a kind of literary criticism that's influence study that never seemed totally satisfying to me, perhaps because as a writer myself, I understood that when you read something, the influence, A, you may not have read everybody who came before you, and B, the influence on you is ephemeral, can be ephemeral, hard to trace, impossible to locate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's influence? And just the fact that somebody came before doesn't necessarily mean that that person was recognized.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, Gertrude Stein and Wittgenstein came to some of the same conclusions about language at the same time, but neither one knew the other existed.
Mm.
The argument is against trying to make sense of history through chronology.
Great.
Yeah.
And how intentional were all of those subjects that you chose?
Oh, pretty intentional. So, I mean, I looked through the dictionary, mm-hmm. and I tried to pick things that not only worked with the preposition, but also represented historical events or considerations that changed, something that changed, things that changed history or life as we know it.
Right.
Yeah.
Are any of them sort of specifically interactive by intention or
Well, how do you mean specifically interactive?
Well,
Song of Songs and Spanish Armada, they're not in chronological order.
No, yeah,
most
that's
definitely
clear, right,
that I wanted to mix up.
Right.
In fact, in an earlier draft, I did have it in chronological order. I had all the references in a chronology, and I thought that would be cool, but then I realized it wasn't so cool.
You know? Well, also in keeping with the A.B. Sedarian, it's fun to have this organized as you do, with all the prepositions in reverse alphabetical order, and I think all
and
of
then
your
the items are in
items
alphabetical, order.
Alphabetical order.
Yeah, again, the randomness of history, the fact that we can't explain everything through the framework of chronology.
Yeah, right. Now, my recollection is that everything in the Catholic Church got blamed on Vatican II, but I
yes,
think you've got
good
Vatican
point.
II in there.
Yeah, I don't. I could put that in there. In fact, I think I'll write that down. That's absolutely right, yeah.
So it must have been a lot of fun to write this.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
seems like writing poetry based on exercises, and not just using exercises as a jumping off point, but actually as mm-hmm. a way of writing, must be particularly fun for a
yeah.
while.
Yeah. Well, like every other poem, there's a discovery in it. And for me, the form, discovering the form is as much fun as discovering the subject.
Mm-hmm.
The form and the subject are connected.
Mm-hmm. What tends to come first for you, form or subject matter or words on paper?
Mm.
That's funny because you just said that, but I...
Yeah. Well,
And maybe it's different with whatever
every
project
poem,
you're
I think it
on.
Is different for every poem. Often, well, the impulse comes out of either something I've read, something I've seen, heard, a snippet of language, a problem that I'm trying to solve, some emotional situation that I want to delve into.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess in that sense the content comes first. But then the process of searching for the form that will not so much convey the content but make the content.
Mm-hmm.
It's deeper than just convey. It's not like the form is a train that carries the content. You know, the form, the content is the train sometimes.
Do your poems always have some formal aspect to them?
Well, the prose poems were an attempt to let go of form.
Uh-huh.
You know, a lot of the letter poems, I could read one if you like.
Yeah,
do you want me to read B or...
Why don't you read B or P? That would be great.
Okay.
Whichever one you...
I think I like B better.
Okay.
So, boar, whose flesh makes a delectable sauce for pappardelle, whose long teeth could crunch a human hand, but whose temper is kept in check rooting truffles under oak trees. After 300 years, wild boar are breeding again in the British countryside. Bones. The human body and the pigs both contain 208, more or less. Human extras usually lodged in the hand, phalanges, or the foot, tarsals, while the pig's vertebrae confuse to ribs, making counting problematic. Remember your fetal pig in high school, its veins and arteries pumped full of red and blue plastic, formaldehyde lingering under your fingernails? Pigs make intelligent and demanding pets, although obesity can be a problem. The devil is often shown with a cloven foot. The herd of swine and devils perished in the waters. The sow fretting the child right in the cradle. A boar's dark bristles make an excellent hairbrush, picking up dust better than plastic, scratching the scalp the way the pig itself might enjoy its skin scratched. My recipe for deviled ham would make you weep. Beelzebub equals Lord of the Flies equals Satan's right-hand man equals Demon of Gluttony. Francis Bacon wrote prose clean as bones. His descendant painted men to look like pigs.
Thank you. So,
the form?
The form.
This one came about from that list that I a list of not so much words I didn't know, but evocative words. So as soon as I got to boar and bones, I realized I had to find out how many bones are in a pig's body. And that took some doing. I finally found a pig specialist at Utah State University who was able to answer it for me. I looked in all sorts of textbooks.
He probably doesn't get that call very often.
Right. Yeah, and I didn't know until I, you know, did this research that neither the human body nor any other mammal body has a definite number of bones, that is variable.
Okay. Based on how you interpret the connections.
Interpretation and also birth, quote-unquote, defects. Oh. That more people than you would think have one of those tiny bones that isn't, you know, where it should be, or have they have an extra one, or...
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
That is interesting.
Yeah.
I found it fascinating that pigs and humans have the same number of bones.
Yeah, and pigs are often said to be the most feeling or intelligent, along with elephants,
mm-hmm.
right,
mm-hmm.
of mm-hmm. the mammals.
So how many drafts might one of your poems go through before you're happy with it?
A lot, usually. Sometimes not so many.
It's just real variable.
Yeah, it's real variable.
Okay.
And I employ my friends as readers. I have a writing group in Salt Lake, and I exchange poems with people through the mail. And the way I decide that something's finished is when I let some time go by and I look at it and I'm not bugged by anything. You know, I sort of am astonished that I wrote it. That it's, you know,
that it's,
this is pretty good.
That
and did I see that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Rather than that nagging feeling that something's still not quite right. And I keep showing it to other people to try to figure out how to fix those nagging problems in it.
Mm-hmm. And what will happen if you feel satisfied with something and your writing group feels that it's not quite there?
Well, I trust them, and I'm pretty good at filtering out their personal biases mm-hmm. and allowing things that they say to touch me. So, in other words, that's all. I almost, if I show it to someone else, I'm ready to accept the criticism. Mm-hmm. I'm not satisfied with it.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm putting it in a context where I want feedback, I really want feedback. I know something's wrong with it. I stop asking for feedback when I'm happy with
You're
it.
You're happy with it. Sure.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the poem Palimpsest a little bit mm-hmm. ago. I'm just wondering if you could read that one and we
sure.
could talk about it a little
sure.
bit.
Okay. And this is a pantun, which is a Malaysian form where the first and third line becomes the second and fourth line of the succeeding stanza, and then the last line of the poem has to be a twist on the very first line of the poem. And the substitutions in sestinas and pantuns, the substitutions are great fun. So you don't have to substitute stuff, but I substituted a lot, and maybe after I read it, I'll tell you about talk about some of the substitutions.
Sure.
Okay. Her last time in Rome, it was warm and damp and crowded. My favorite city, a palimpsest. That's what she likes to say. The first time, she's 20 and studies all the churches. Interiors uncrowded. Her favorite city, a palimpsest. Some exteriors, Santa Maria della Pace. More than 20 churches, inside or out, in 7 days. She stays at the Pensione Terminus, 2 miles outside Pietra de Cortona's portico, run by a courtly proprietor and his German wife, for 7 days. She stays at the Pensione Terminus, the rooms enormous, high-ceilinged, the silver shining. The courtly proprietor and his younger German wife offer white rolls, butter, marmalade, and jam. Enormous rooms, high-ceilinged, the silver scratched. The fourth time she is married, the owner has a cane, offers white rolls, butter, marmalade, and jam. At La Buca di Ripetta, the waiters do not change. The fifth time she is married, the maitre d' shuffles a bit. The antipasto table seems wondrous, squid she's never had. The Buca di Ripetta waiters finally change. At Archimedes, she and Catherine lunch with workers. The antipasto table's gone. She orders squid. She dreams of campaniles and baldacchinos. The last time, Archimedes, where she and Kathy lunch with workers, is closed, and she sees tourists, decaffeinato, everywhere. Bernini's heavy campaniles had to be torn down. The terminus is gone, replaced by four-star glyphs. Eyes closed, she hears tourists, froth, milk everywhere. Here lies ashes, dust, and nothing. A. Barberini's epitaph. The sky replete with stars she cannot see. Her time is short. Nostalgia's a mistake. A Barberini's epitaph. Hic jacet pulvis, sinus e nihil. The first time in Rome she buys an ivory bracelet. Her time is short. She wants a souvenir. Here lies one whose name is writ in water. The first time in Rome she brought an ivory bracelet she's now ashamed to wear. Dolce vita, vita brevis. Here lies one whose name is writ in water. Rome was warm and damp and not the same, she says.
Thank you. I had to look up palimpsest, to be honest.
All right.
And once I knew what it meant, I loved the way that it implies that which has come before and that which comes after. You know, it in fact means that something was written on a piece of paper, erased, and is still visible in behind the new writing. Correct?
Yes, yes. And the ruins in Rome are just like that. Mm. You know, there'll be different buildings built on top of ruins, on top of other buildings, and you have all the layers of history somehow peeking through.
Right. And then there's her story of what came before and what is following, which is fun.
Yeah. And this is, you know, the she or the her is a version of me or me, and most of the details are biographically true. Because when I lived in Europe, I always used to say Rome was my favorite city. I lived in Paris for a while, in Germany and Switzerland, but I always vacationed in Rome. And I think it appealed to me partly because of the history, the art history, because I was almost an art history major in college. I loved especially architecture.
Yeah.
So I knew all the churches. And the fact that Rome, unlike Paris or London, is a very small city, mile-wise or kilometer-wise. You can cover the center of Rome on foot and not feel overwhelmed by it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not true for Paris or London or a lot of other cities. So it's an easy city to be a tourist in that sense. You get a feel for it very fast.
Now, why has that remained the same? Is it geographically confined in some way?
The suburbs, I don't know why. They have this little train that goes to the circumlavazione that goes around the city. The suburbs, you know what, I do know why. The interior, the things that tourists visit remain the same and are all in the center because of the history of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of stopped in the 19th century as opposed to Paris, which Haussmann redid in the 19th century, opened it up and added all this new layer of architecture.
Okay.
So I think it had to do with the height or the antiquities being interesting and being in the very center of Rome.
And staying confined.
Yeah.
Now, you include the epitaphs of Cardinal Barberini and Keats. I looked it up and figured out it was Keats.
Okay.
But you don't name Keats, and you don't necessarily place Barberini in context. So I was curious if you enjoy placing ideas into your poetry that leave it to the reader to either look into it and educate themselves a little bit or just to enjoy it.
Yeah.
Do you like leaving little mysteries?
Sure, sure. I figure if anybody... I want the poem to work even if you don't know all where the stuff came from, but if you want to look it up, it'll maybe enrich it a bit. And I abhor footnotes in poems because I tell you why. You never know what your reader will know, and you always risk insulting someone's intelligence.
Sure.
Because any time that the writer makes a decision to explain something in the poem, there's somebody out there who already, of course, knew it. knows it.
Now that's very interesting because in, mm-hmm. in fiction, mm-hmm. you'll see that in within the prose, you know, you'll see a dialogue where someone's over-explaining something mm-hmm. to someone else mm-hmm. within the actual dialogue, and I think that can be very insulting. In poetry, you really would need a footnote in order mm-hmm. to overdo that,
uh-huh.
right?
Mostly. Yeah, and there are writers who, and some poets mock that tendency of the footnote, and those are kind of fun. When they're, I think Lucy Brock Broder does that in her first book. That's kind of fun when you're playing with the seriousness of footnotes, or when they're ludicrous, like sort of like Nabokov's Pale Fire, when they're
right.
when they create a text on their own. But some writers take them quite seriously, and they that it's pompous. It comes across as pompous.
Yeah. Now, do you ever have to tell a student that?
Not to footnotes. No, students never footnote their poems. No, it's only people, I think, at a certain... Once you've published a book, you feel like you have to, document yourself in that way.
Your poem, E, mm-hmm. Tells something of a more straightforward story, I think, than some of the other poems.
Yeah.
It struck me that way. I wonder if you'd read that one.
Okay. So this is a list, and it alternates words that start with E with just a very narrative that happened to me when I was 11. So, essay, to try, from exagere, to weigh out, examine. I was 11 and watching the galloping gourmet with his British-Australian accent and his glass of wine, learning how to get juice out of a lemon by rolling it hard on the counter. When the doorbell rang, my hair around cans to make it straight. The man next door, his receding hair combed back. Erminia, the weasel whose fur turns from brown to white in winter. Asked if anyone else were home. I said no. Edentate, lacking teeth. Asked if he could come in. Electric, from Greek, electron, amber, because it produces sparks when rubbed. I said no, I'm sorry. Euphemism, to speak with good words. We stood eye to eye. Eutrophic, a body of water with so much mineral and organic matter, the oxygen is reduced. Until I slowly shut the door in his face. Eve, from Hebrew, living, pushing with both hands.
Great. I love that. Thank you.
Yeah. And it was the process of looking at these E words that made me recall this incident that I had forgotten or repressed.
Oh, wow.
And then I realized what danger I was in. You know how inappropriate is too tame a word
right.
for what he was trying to do.
And it's interesting to me that you were as confident as you were at 11.
Uh-huh.
To push that door. I mean, how many 11-year-old girls, maybe even particularly of our generation, would have been comfortable to close that door in his
face? On a neighbor. Yeah. My parents had told me, never let in people when we're not home. And my mother had probably just gone around the corner or something. And I was just at that age where you as a parent probably, you know, you want to trust your child to make the good decision, and it's only going to be an hour or two, and you think they'll be fine.
Right. Would you have told them when they got home what happened?
I didn't.
Oh, you didn't?
I didn't. No. I didn't tell anyone. And, you know, later the man, he beat his wife. You know, later we realized that. And there was a restraining order, I believe. And he killed their cat by running over it in a car. And he left. So this same guy who's very creepy, and God knows what else he did that I didn't know about, but those are the things I learned about. We stayed in that house maybe another year, and the woman, the wife also moved away.
Mm. As far as the actual poem goes, I loved the use of Erminia in the poem.
Mm-hmm.
Am I saying that right?
You know, I don't know. I never took Latin, which is a problem. I need to learn the Latin pronunciation of all the words
it's
I use.
Like Spanish, I don't know.
Yeah,
probably not. Or Italian. But the reader already sort of knows not to trust this man whose receded hair is combed back. I feel like that was a little bit of a clue, but especially after the weasel reference, it's like, yeah, no.
Right.
It's a bad guy.
Right.
And I loved the reference to the Galloping Gourmet, who I had not thought about in forever and ever.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I learned to cook by watching Julia Child and the Galloping Gourmet.
Yeah. Your work, to me, it doesn't seem like itself in any way, you know, from one poem to the next. I'm guessing that you love the variety of choices available to you.
Yes. I live in fear of repeating something that I already know how to do. So every writing activity has to be something, unless I'm doing it purely to make money, but every writing activity has to be something challenging that I've never done before or that I have to figure out. And I think that a lot of poets get praised for what they know how to do well, and then they just repeat ad nauseum. And I'm just in fear of that. So that's why, you know, my second book was very different from my first book, and my third book will be different from the other two. And every poem is different from every other poem. And I catch myself. Sometimes I find myself falling into a comfortable pattern. Oh, I already know how to do this. And I have to resist because it's too easy.
Do you think that readers, you know, I think that with other genres, perhaps, readers will pick up a book and hope that it's a lot like the last one, or there's a certain kind of reader who looks for that. Do you think that poetry enthusiasts are less likely to be doing that?
No, I think there's some of that at work, too.
Is there?
Yeah. So, in fact, that's probably why my second book wasn't taken by my first publisher. You know, it was too different. He was expecting another version of Red Under the Skin, and I had grown beyond that.
Okay. Your husband, Tyrone, died this year. And in April, the New York Times published a wonderful article that you had written titled Down to the Wire. I'm just wondering if you can talk about writing this article, which was just wonderful.
Yes. Well, yeah, he died in December, and I started writing notes for the essay already in December and January. And I should say what the essay is about. It's about watching the HBO series The Wire while he was dying, and we knew he would die. We lived in Baltimore for 20 years, and the Wire is filled with very gritty realism. And there was something comforting about watching poverty, drugs, murder, despair, combined with joy, hope, possibility. The realism of that series was, and I should say that I don't watch TV, and since he died, I have not turned on the TV once. But this was something we could do together, and we both loved it. So the act of writing the essay was really a way of coming to terms with his illness and his death. His illness was 3 years. He was ill with lymphoma, a very rare kind that was difficult to treat.
And he'd been through a series of treatments earlier.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah. From the moment it was diagnosed, he'd been through five different chemos, including a bone marrow transplant.
Right, you mentioned that in
The only thing that might have saved him would have been a bone marrow transplant with donor cells.
Okay.
You know, and because he was Caribbean, no donor could be found. Mm. Because that makes sense. In Jamaica, a very disorganized country, people don't know about bone marrow transplants and signing up as donors. And that's where that population is found. There were actually two donors who were found in England, but they both changed their minds.
Oh.
So perhaps something your listeners might be interested in. The National Bone Marrow Foundation is a place where you can sign up to donate stem cells. And the way you are typed is just by a cheek swab, so it's not invasive at all. But I think once you're in that registry, you should be willing to go through with it. Because, I mean, they weren't absolutely perfect matches, but they would have given him the next possibility of hope. And there are, you know, rejection when you introduce any foreign substance into the body. The body, you know, rejects it. So you have to take all these immunosuppressants like prednisone, steroids, and there are all kinds of horrible side effects from that.
Right.
But it is for last ditch therapies. That is the one that holds out the most hope.
Okay.
Yeah. I showed it to my writing group. And then I showed it to people who had lived in Baltimore. Uh-huh. I showed it to a journalist friend who wrote for many years for the Baltimore Sun and had seen The Wire, because I wanted very much to get it right. So I showed it in that space of like 2 or 3 weeks. I showed it to a lot of people. And then your listeners might be interested to know that the Modern Love column in the New York Times is open to anyone. All you do is email your piece, I believe it's 1,700 words, to Dan Jones at the Modern Love, it's modernlove@newyorktimes.com, and he apparently reads them all.
Wow.
And then he had some, not a whole lot, but he had some editing suggestions.
Did the piece begin for you as a piece that you wanted to publish, or did it begin as a journal entry? Or?
Oh, I knew I wanted to publish it.
You did?
Because I wanted a public obituary for Tyrone. Mm. I knew he wasn't famous enough to have an obituary in the New York Times, so I wanted to write one. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to write something very public that would document our 30-year marriage.
Yeah, yeah. Do you mind if I just read a paragraph
sure.
of it? I once read an article about interracial marriage that told me what I already knew. Interracial couples are more likely to stay together. After you face the wrath of family, the stares, the cold shoulders, the stupid comments, you create a bond and other people become irrelevant. Our love spanning 30 years seems to me to go beyond words, but I can write about the last months of Tyrone's life, during which the realism of a gritty television program gave us joy. I enjoyed the way that you wove racial theme into this, which obviously was very important within your life together. And it's also so important in The Wire. And I was interested to read that interracial couples are more likely to stay together.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed
mm-hmm.
really true.
Yes,
yeah.
yes.
I mean, it must
yes.
be. If you can put up with everybody else, you can put up with each other.
Right, right. And there's that element of proving something. You know, proving everybody wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The naysayers, the people who say, oh, you know, you'll just wait 6 months and this will be over.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. He's experimenting or she's experimenting.
Right.
Or, yeah. Yeah. And it sounds like you had some pretty negative reactions from the outside world occasionally, which I suppose is...
Well, not that many, but certainly my parents were not initially accepting.
Mm.
But they came around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, little incidents here and there. The most troubling things are the things sometimes that people don't do, the absences. You wonder how life would be different if people, you know, weren't racist.
Yeah.
You know,
so, right.
And that you can't measure. You know, you have no action. You have nothing to pin that on. You don't know what the answer is.
Yeah. And it's such a tragic state in this country because we're kind of stuck with it for now anyway.
Yes, and the fact that we have a biracial president, African-American president, does not change it.
No.
It doesn't. You know, when I wrote this essay, a few people said to me, well, now that Barack Obama is president, this is not an issue anymore. And that's absolutely not true.
Yeah.
Racism is part of us, and one of the examples I give in the essay is that no one is exempt from it. Not even people. Not even me. Not even people who are black. Everyone. It's the air we breathe.
Mm-hmm.
It's the web we're all caught in. We're all racist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and we can't forget it, even though we try to or want to.
Yeah, right. There was a quote in the article that I wanted to just mention. You cite an Alice Walker poem that starts, "Expect nothing, live frugally on surprise." Mm-hmm. So can you just talk about how that line affected you?
Yeah. I love the idea that that every day is a gift, that everything is, that you can't expect it. You can't expect anything in life. You can't expect anything to be handed to you or any goodness to come to you. But then it does, and it's this wonderful gift. So the surprise part is that, well, watching The Wire was a surprise. I mean, who knew that we didn't know when we started it that watching this really gritty show full of horrible things would create a bond for us and actually, in a bizarre way, make us happy for the time that, not that we were happy watching people, you know, die of drug overdoses, but the realism in the TV program was parallel to the realism in our lives. That, and it's good to not have false expectations sometimes.
Mm. And particularly with your tie to Baltimore, I would think that was something
absolutely
important.
We recognized all the street corners and the lingo, and
yeah. You wrote an essay in the AWP Chronicle, mm-hmm. called Rhythm and Repetition in Free Verse, or The Poet as Witch. Mm-hmm. And one of the quotes from that, and it's actually only half a quote, but you wrote, "Often the meaning of words is not as important as their rhythmic sounds." Mm-hmm. And I believe the quote goes on to say, and sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, it's the other way around. Mm-hmm. But so that, when I was reading the poem H, it made me think about that quote. It seemed perhaps that the meaning of in that poem was not as important as the rhythmic sounds. I'm wondering if you would agree or if you...
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
And I'm wondering if you could read that one.
Yeah, and I discovered looking at the dictionary that a lot of compound nouns start with H. Oh. Who knew? So that's how this one came. So then it's a sonnet,
okay,
with a turn in the last two. It's a Shakespearean sonnet with a pretty much iambic pentameter, with that last couplet being the turn. And then my assignment to myself was to use as many of those compound words as possible.
Which are really fun to read.
Yeah, they are fun.
They're very fun.
Fun to read, fun to say. And then the poem is an argument, I believe, as well as a song. So I see this as a rebellion against conventional domesticity.
Yeah.
But I'll read it. "Oh, how we hanky-panky harum-scarum in our happy home, dancing hoochie-coochie. Sure, it makes for hugger-mugger, but we give a hoot for happenstance. The yard is full of hound and hares, the door adorned by hammer and sickle, in the closets hand-me-downs. If Hammurabi and his queen come by, we won't be hoity-toity. We'll offer haggis or humble pie. Our bed floats on hocus-pocus, our corpore holy habeas, and the kitchen hums a hymn, hail to higgly-piggly. If the world can't call our hurly-burly hunky-dory, let it harakiri if it dares."
What writers have influenced you, Natasha, either personally or through their works?
Okay. Well, I am a scholar of the novel, so my scholarly work was in the 18th, 19th century novel. So people like Henry James and George Eliot, I refer to the work of novelists as often as I do to the work of poets.
Uh-huh.
In terms of poetry, C.D. Wright, the work of C.D. Wright was a revelation for me because she taught me about form. Somehow I knew about form from a form class when I was at Hopkins, where we were all writing sonnets and iambic pentameter, but I never knew that you could invent forms. So she was the one who unlocked that for me.
Mm.
And I love the work of Ann Carson, and I love the work of Wanda Coleman and Paul Muldoon. I love a lot of people. Oh, William Olson, my colleague mm-hmm. at Vermont College. I aspire to that level of philosophical and linguistic awareness. I never get tired of reading Bill's the poems in his latest book just stun me.
Hmm. What are you reading now?
Well, I'm reading, quite literally, I'm reading a little pamphlet from the Seattle Art Museum about the vivarium there. You know, there's this nurse log. Do you know what that is?
No.
this artist, I've forgotten his name, Mark something, took a log that was in the Northwest Forest, and it had become an ecosystem of its own, and transported it to a busy street corner in Seattle, and covered it with glass, and it is its own little eco-environment.
Oh, interesting.
And it's called the vivarium.
Oh.
So that's what I'm reading. I'm trying to think what the poem might be that is... I love the idea. I mean, what's not to like about a log that's
right.
covered in moss? I mean, it's kind of like a teddy bear. It's so lovable. But
well, it also reminds me of when you can see a beehive that somebody
yes.
set up with some sort of window into it, because it's so fascinating.
Yes.
Or an ant
yes.
Hill. You know, it's so fascinating to see
uh-huh.
that whole activity.
Uh-huh.
And,
But I want to get beyond the level of just admiring it mm-hmm. and get to some, you know, maybe sociological understanding of why we all love this thing or what it means. I'll probably play off the word vivarium. I think it's an inventive word. I'd never heard it before. So the vivarium as opposed to the mausoleum, or the opposite of a necro something, you know.
Right.
Viva life and necro, or mazo death. So
yeah.
Some juxtaposition.
And it rhymes with Amy Sedarium.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Right.
Oh, that sounds fun. So what advice do you have for writers who occasionally get stuck in their work
oh, yes.
or have trouble moving forward?
Okay. Open the dictionary.
I
yes.
love that.
It's so easy. Even fiction writers can do it.
Yeah.
The way I do it in my poems, and not necessarily these, but even in my first book, when I got stuck, I would open the dictionary and force the whatever word at random that I... my finger found, force it into the poem, like hammering open a door.
Mm.
And you don't know where it's going to go, and then maybe in a later revision you block it up again, but it has allowed you to get some air into the work.
And look at it a new way.
Yes.
Maybe. Right.
Yes.
Interesting. Wow, wonderful.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Shayla.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Natasha Saye. You can read more about her work at her Westminster College website, people.westminstercollege.edu/faculty/NSAGE. Today's Write the Book prompt is to draft an essay for the New York Times Modern Love column. Their submission guidelines include the following advice. The editors of Modern Love are interested in receiving deeply personal essays about contemporary relationships, marriage, dating, parenthood, any subject that might reasonably fit under the heading Modern Love. Ideally, essays should spring from some central dilemma the writer has faced in his or her life. It helps if the situation has a contemporary edge, though this is not essential. Most important is that the writing be emotionally honest and the story be freshly and compellingly told. So draft an essay for the column. I'm going to put the website for the New York Times submission guidelines on my podcast site. Draft an essay for the column. Set it aside for a week and then decide what, if anything, you might want to do with it. Revise and perfect it and send it to the New York Times if you like, or take the material you put into that draft and turn it into something else, a poem or a story or a new aspect of another work in progress. Or maybe you won't want to take it any further, but the act of creating that first draft is your prompt for this week. Good luck with it, and please listen next week for another. Write Write the Book has a Facebook page now. If you're a Facebook user, please like Write the Book Radio Show. Thanks very much. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, or if you have a writing prompt to suggest, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If I use your writing prompt, I will credit you for it. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.